Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Small details or big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems, too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Super Real.
Hey, I'm Julian Morgans, and you're listening to What It Was Like, the show that asks people who have lived through big, dramatic events what it was like. Hey, thanks for joining me again. So this coming Sunday, it's going to be 28 years since Australia's worst mass shooting. This was the Port Arthur Massacre, which happened on the 28th of April, 1996. And I think for a lot of Australians, and especially for the ones who don't live in Tasmania or weren't alive at the time, the Port Arthur Massacre feels like an increasingly distant part of history. But also, I think maybe this was a mass shooting, which seems like a distinctly American phenomenon and maybe gives it this air of foreignness. And I think these were the reasons that I wanted to revisit the case. So we started pulling this episode together a couple of weeks ago, and then something happened. Just something happened that made Port Arthur resonate again, and that was the recent stabbings in Sydney. So if you're listening to this from overseas, a 40-year-old man recently killed 6 people at a shopping centre in Bondi with a knife, and it's this baffling, tragic crime that's led to this discussion about violence against women. All but one of the victims in Bondi were female. And I think a broader look at violence against women, it's an issue that I really want to do a whole episode on it. But it's not this episode. Anyway, the point is that suddenly the stabbings in Sydney have made Port Arthur feel to me like it's a lot more in the present. And also, I think it's important to just not forget the victims. I know that if I lost a family member at Port Arthur, I'd want everyone to just keep talking about Port Arthur forever. I wouldn't want their absence in the world to just become accepted, or the deeply unfair way that they died to become ignored. So let's talk a little bit about what happened, starting with the perpetrator, Martin Bryant. Martin was born in 1967 in Hobart, Tasmania, and he was the first child of Maurice and Carlene Bryant. As Martin grew up, he was diagnosed with various personality disorders, intellectual impairment, and potentially Asperger's. And then, in one of this story's weirder twists, Martin Bryant, at the age of 19, he became good friends with a local heiress. And this was a reclusive woman named Helen Harvey, who had inherited a share of a gambling company fortune. And things really went off the rails in 1992, when Helen Harvey was killed in a car accident. Martin was a passenger in the car at the time, and it's suspected that he'd pulled on the steering wheel as a kind of a prank. Apparently, this was something he liked to do. Then a year later, Martin's dad died by suicide, and the young Martin Bryant suddenly found himself without any parental support and loads of money. Martin Bryant inherited both Helen's fortune and the proceeds of his dad's superannuation fund, which netted him close to $1 million. And over the next few years, he spent lavishly on clothes, as we'll hear in today's interview. But he also took up international travel as a full-time hobby. When it comes to why he committed the massacre, He provided some pretty conflicting and confused accounts, so I won't speculate. But here's the basic timeline. April 28, 1996 was a Sunday, and Port Arthur was filled with families and tourists. Port Arthur is a former convict settlement in Tasmania, dating from the early 1800s. And these days, it's a collection of roofless stone buildings on an estate of trees and grassy hills. It's a pretty nice spot, and tourists go there to do history tours during the day and ghost tours at night. Martin Bryant paid the entry fee and walked to a cafe on the grounds called the Broad Arrow Cafe. He was seen entering with a large duffel bag. There, he ate some lunch, then took a video camera out of his bag and set it on a table. Then he pulled out a Colt AR-15 rifle from his bag and started shooting. And I'm not going to go into detail here, but if you want that kind of thing, it's online. I read through a few pages of just grueling court documents, and it sounded like the most hellish chaos imaginable. But I will say, there's also these little moments, these truly incredible heroes who just emerge. So for example, this guy, this New Zealand guy named Jason Winter. And Jason Winter is there with his daughter and his wife and his father-in-law. And just as the gun gets aimed at his wife, Jason throws like a big metal serving tray at Martin Bryant, which distracts him long enough for the daughter and the mom to hide behind a table. Now, Jason tragically got shot, but the mother and the baby daughter, they both survived. And Martin didn't have, you know, there was no ideology to his actions. He just shot men, women, children. His victims were just whoever had the atrocious luck of being nearby. In total, 35 people lost their lives. And for this, Martin Bryant rightly received 35 life sentences with no chance of parole. And he's been incarcerated ever since at the maximum security Risdon prison near Hobart. Australia became a different place after that. I think largely thanks to some pretty swift and dramatic gun regulation that was rolled in by the federal government. And now it's basically impossible for average people to own guns. In Australia, unless you're a farmer or a sports person and you can pass some fairly rigorous background checks, you can't own a gun. And for anyone who's listening to this in the States and who's wondering what kind of society that's created, I've got to say, it's peaceful. But that's not to say Australia has solved the problem of angry men. I mean, like I said at the start, we just lost 6 people to an angry man with a knife the other day. But I'm grateful he didn't have a gun. So what's happening here? Who are these men? To find out, I wanted to hear from someone who knew Martin to get a better understanding of how travesties like this can occur. I'm curious whether Hobart's locals were surprised when this happened or whether Martin was a known threat. So I tracked down 2 people who grew up in the house next door to him. This is Mick and Lorraine Davies. They're brother and sister, and they grew up along with Martin in a suburb of North Hobart called Newtown. I'll let them introduce themselves. But I gotta say, Lorraine and Mick are incredibly smart, articulate people, and I was impressed with their ability to recall so many details from nearly 3 decades ago, and just to draw some conclusions from what they remember. So that's to say, I hope you'll enjoy my conversation with Lorraine and Mick Davies. Mick and Lorraine, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hey, Julian, thanks.
Let's start with some quick introductions. Lorraine, tell me about yourself.
I'm a mum, 2 kids, 8 and 10. I live in Taroona, not far away from where Mick and I grew up. I'm a school counsellor, love my job, and I love Tasmania. I love living in Tassie.
She's also really smart, is a member of the Golden Key Society, which apparently is a big deal. Ooh, I don't know.
What
went
is that?
Went to uni for ages. Look, I don't know. It's some Illuminati thing, but I think she's selling herself short there. Yeah.
Thanks, Mick.
And Mick, how would you describe yourself?
Father. Just turned 40, so looking forward to my midlife crisis kicking in. I've been a public servant for a great many years, but also an actor, and I started doing stand-up comedy. How's that sound?
That's great. That's perfect. So take us back to the 90s. I'm guessing it was early 90s up until around the mid-90s in Hobart. Tell me what it was like to live there.
We had an idyllic childhood, really.
Yeah, we were very, very lucky, particularly where we lived in a place called Newtown.
Yeah, all the families, various kids, all different ages would all meet up in the morning and we'd play until it was dinner time and our dad would get on the back step and whistle really loudly and then we knew it was time to go home.
Yeah. So that was like the dinner bell was when dad would whistle and we'd be like, it's getting dark. Can you hear, did dad whistle? And be like, yeah, yeah. Oh, shit. Okay, we got to run home now.
So I want to go back to your earliest memories, living on this street with Martin Bryant as a neighbor. Lorraine, we'll start with you. Can you tell me about some of your earliest memories of living next door to this guy?
We lived just near a tennis court. And to get down to that tennis court, we would have to go down a little grass sort of passage, and that was running past Martin Bryant's house. He had a really big backyard and he was often out in the backyard when we would go down the passage, and he was always sort of climbing up on the fence trying to talk to us and interact with us.
How old was he at that time?
He would have probably been a teenager when we were mid to late primary school. So he was about 13 years older than us.
And what was your impression at that time of the people who lived next door? You know, did you see much of them? Did you hear much of them?
We didn't really see much of the mum. We saw a little bit of the dad. Yeah, very, very private people. And we all sensed that Martin's interactions were a little odd, little strange. We're all a little bit wary of him.
Can you give me some detail on that? What was odd or strange about him?
Yeah, look, he was very immature for his age. You know, he would have been a teenager climbing up on the fence and wanting to play with, you know, little kids. He was so desperate and really trying to impress us with the latest toys and, you know, Nintendo games, that sort of stuff. Yeah, we just felt it was very forced.
Mm. Like even at that age, it felt a bit thirsty.
Yeah.
It was a bit desperate.
Yeah. We just had this sense that it wasn't, it just didn't feel right going into his backyard. Yeah.
Yeah. Mick, how about you? What are some of your earliest memories of the family next door and their son?
Yeah, that, because I'm about, well, 3.5 years younger than Lorraine, so I was a little bit younger. But, yeah, when my mind goes back to there, I remember just it had to have been an innate sense that this dude's weird because we never, as kids, we never really actively spoke about Martin and how weird he was.
No.
But we all just sort of collectively knew, and I think some of that was probably coloured by, you know, a couple of the things we'd heard.
Mm.
But, it sounds basic, but the vibe, I mean, it was just, even as a kid, because I would have been 4 or 5 when I first started interacting with him, even then I was just like, this feels very, odd, out of place, because it's not like I hadn't met teenagers before, but this dude was different altogether.
But it was, I suppose, him scrambling up onto the fence to look over at us, and a real vacant stare that he had that was quite off-putting.
Mm. Tell me more about that. I find that really interesting. What does a vacant stare look like?
Like he was looking through you.
Yeah. It sounds kind of cliche, but it, like, I think all you'd have to do is Google a picture of this guy and you'll kind of get a pretty good understanding of what the vacant stare is. But, like, to complement that, yeah, it was unemotive, and it was also, it was always just like conversation by numbers as well, as in there'd be, you know, hi, how are you, and, you know, call and response. And there was no natural flow to it. Even as kids, you could sort of gather that, like, he's in a position of authority, he's an older guy.
Mm.
And, yeah, he'd just sort of, like, peer over the fence Yeah, I just remember being scared of him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Scared. You'd say scared?
We were all scared of him. We would all run past his property as fast as we could because we didn't feel safe interacting with him.
I remember listening out for like the treading of leaves underfoot because sometimes he'd be there, sometimes he wouldn't. But whenever we go down there, I'd always be thinking, oh, man, I hope he's not there. And like more often than not, he would be. And I'd be like, I'd always think like, what are you doing over there?
What did he look like at this time? Can you give me a bit of a visual idea? What am I imagining?
Very blonde hair.
Mm.
So he was really easy to spot amongst the leaves. Typical 80s short hair.
Sort of big eyes, like big blue eyes.
Yeah, huge blue eyes.
But like, I don't.
Braces.
Yeah. I remember thinking that he wasn't like ugly or handsome or but yeah, I guess it was the eyes that for me, because they were just so big and hollow.
I mean, on paper you're describing a good looking kid, you know, blonde hair and blue eyes. But
it
just
wasn't ugly,
you know. These component parts didn't make a good whole.
No awkward, stilted sort of behavior. And the vacant stare, was quite off-putting.
So tell me about, you'd heard stories, you know, you'd heard the adults, you'd heard your parents talk about, I guess it sort of sounds like neighborhood rumors, you know, one parent saw this or a family down the street saw this.
Mm-hmm.
Give me an idea of what you were hearing.
They would intuit that this kid, he was a wrong'un, as in, he had the air rifle, which was like pretty uncommon, particularly in the city. Like air rifles felt like, you know, country activities.
Yeah.
But like for him to be shooting, and really where his yard was, like, you know, he'd be shooting at the fence and that's the fence we'd all walk past. Mm.
Yeah, that's what Mum and Dad were most concerned about, us getting shot with an air rifle running down that.
But yeah, the story that Dad would tell is that, there was a tree not far from his house. Yeah, that the lorikeets would nest in. And the story that Dad tells is that he basically decimated the whole tree full of lorikeets. And I haven't seen them since. Like, I can't think of.
No.
No.
So you still live in the area. You see the tree and there's no lorikeets in it to this day.
No. No, that's right. We've got ravens and cockatoos and magpies coming back, which is great, but we've never seen that variety of bird actually, which is kind of awful, really.
Yep.
Yeah, it is kind of bizarre that even like he was barely in his teenage years and he was just already killing indiscriminately. It's really
such a beautiful bird.
Yeah, and like it is a beautiful bird. There's just no need to do that at all. It doesn't bode well.
No. So the picture you're painting, I think, is really interesting. On the one hand, you guys are describing this idyllic childhood, you know, running around the streets with your friends. Yeah. You're given a pretty long leash. And then on the other hand, there's this kid next door who you both say that you're scared of him. You know, he's got this vacant 1,000-mile stare.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
It feels like, do you know the movie The Sandlot Kids where they'd all play baseball and stuff like that? But if they'd hit the ball over the fence, there'd be this wild dog that no one would go into the yard. So, yeah, like we had a great time mucking around, but we always knew just not to go anywhere near Martin.
Yeah, yep. It's a great way of describing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to love that movie.
Yeah.
Okay, so the years trickle on and you guys were, for better or worse, kind of all growing up together on the street. Tell me about just some memories along the way of what was it like living next door to Martin Bryant?
I remember we had the treehouse in the backyard. We remember the treehouse, which Dad had built for us. And we'd hang out up there and occasionally we'd see Martin wander down the street and we'd have these weird conversations where we'd be up in the treehouse being like, get out of here. And then he'd be down there sort of like always trying to
– staring up at the treehouse.
Always trying to impress us and stuff. I remember – I have a vivid memory of him trying to trade the Barbie Nintendo game with me.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's right.
I just,
yeah.
Like, you know, it might have been an immature thought, but I just remember thinking, what is this, like, 18-year-old kid doing with the Barbie Nintendo game? Why is he trying to trade it with me? It just all felt like, I don't know where the conversation was going all the time, but yeah, there was always a lingering question of why are you interacting? Don't you have friends your own age? Like, shouldn't you be playing the Terminator game or something? I mean, not to apply gender to the gaming industry, but
I know what you mean, though. I know what you mean, especially at that point. You know, in the 90s, if you're a self-respecting teenager, you know, growing up in a fairly, I don't know, Australian country towns or regional cities, I guess, were macho places then. And if you're trying to swap the Barbie video game, and you're not even aware of how deeply uncool that is, and you're trying to use it like a bit of bait, like, I will swap you the official Barbie video game. You're like, mate.
It's the worst bargaining chip, isn't it?
It's like so bad.
Of all the ones. I would have taken Dr. Mario. I mean, even that game.
Seriously. But, he had no idea thing's market value was, which was piss all.
So zero social credit score, But, I don't know. You would have a lot more memories than me, but I remember being scared of him as a kid, and then he kind of disappeared for a while, in my head, and when he came back,
he was still living there though. Apparently, became more of a recluse.
Right. Okay. So he kind of stopped trying, and then it really felt like he made more effort. So I would have been 10, 9 or 10, and you would have been 12, 13.
Yeah.
And that's when he sort of reappeared.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Mm. So, Lorraine, tell me about Martin's reappearance.
So there were a group of girls, we're all about the same age. Yeah, we'd all hit puberty and he started paying a bit more attention to us, which was, pretty awkward. And, we were just so young and innocent, only about 12, 13. And he would have been in his 20s at this stage.
Yeah, maybe 23 or something.
Yeah.
Because if
he's 13 years older, so it would have been.
Jesus, maybe even 25. Yeah.
He asked one of my friends out, but it was in a really childish, sort of awkward fashion.
Yeah, yeah.
Can
you set the scene on that a little bit? Like, where were you and what did he say?
Yeah, so we were playing on some of the tyre swings in the paddock near where we lived, and Martin appears as a young adult. Yeah, we felt uneasy because he was sort of standing there staring for a while. Then he came over and asked one of my mates out to be his girlfriend.
They were the words that he used.
Yeah. Yeah. So really quite forced and awkward. Yeah, it was quite bizarre, really.
How did your friend respond?
She was really frightened and she said, no, I'm going inside. And I remember we jumped the fence and just ran into her house, and we actually hid in her bedroom. That's how frightened we were. And Martin then went to her front door and spoke to her mother and really tried to, I suppose, come across like he was a, really good catch. He was talking to her mum and said, I'd really like to be your daughter's boyfriend, and showed a gold watch that he was wearing and was trying to impress her with the gold watch. Yeah, it was all very, very
That's
bizarre.
So bizarre.
Yeah, we could overhear it from her bedroom. Yeah, we were really quite frightened.
Do you remember how the mother was responding?
She was pretty shocked and, just had a general chat with him and tried to get him out. And she couldn't make sense of it all.
Yeah.
And she was worried about us because we were obviously quite frightened.
Yeah. I mean, so let's say this guy was 25 and you guys were 13. Yeah. I mean, this, I don't know, I've got to ask the question. Did you read some sort of, like, was there some sort of pedophilic impulse going on here? Or was it much more about he was just, like, lonely and any young woman was a object of his desire?
Like, it's hard to look back on it without looking at it through an adult lens. But at the time, yeah, we just thought he was lonely and just wanted to sort of impress people. And like all the sort of adults in our life just said, oh, that's just Martin, like just stay away from him.
Mm.
Yeah, so obviously no report to the police or anything like that. That's just how it was dealt with.
So, I mean, you're a mother now. I mean, when you reflect on this moment.
Oh, it's very concerning. Yeah. I've got a 10-year-old daughter. You know, it's only a couple of years away and she'll be that age that I was at. I'd certainly be calling the police.
Yeah. Hey, we're going to stop here for a quick ad break, but we'll be right back with more What It Was Like.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Was there any sort of sense of violence or aggression about him, or was it just creepy and like a sort of conversation by numbers type way, like Mick said before?
Well, the only violence that we really knew of was towards animals. We didn't feel necessarily, you know, physically intimidated by him, even though he was, you know, an adult and we were quite young. It was more, just a creepy sort of vibe that we all got.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. I don't think I was ever, like, scared of violence from him.
No.
There were definitely other teenagers I knew that I was more scared of, like, physically. But yeah, it was just creepy and this deep sense in the center of your chest where it's like, I just don't want to be around this person. I just can't see this interaction going well, so I'd just rather not have it.
And I remember talking to our mum and dad about it, and, you know, looking back, I can see that they were quite concerned. But I remember them saying, you've got an instinct for a reason. You need to listen to that instinct, and that's telling you, not to have anything to do with Martin. So listen to it, stay away from him.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you guys did the right thing, but like being approached by a grown man.
Yeah.
Like, no. And you ran away, and that was,
and we told our parents.
But credit to you. I think that was pretty.
Yeah.
Pretty smart.
Back then, though, I don't think there was the same knowledge of pedophilia that's available to us today. There's no internet. So, mum and dad wouldn't have really known what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, with that. Mm.
But I feel like Martin was a known entity.
Yeah.
Not just in Newtown, but, people knew. People knew that he was strange. Mm. He'd go into pubs and people would be like, oh, Christ, Martin's here.
Mm.
So there was an acknowledgement that this guy was weird, but I don't think any of us really made the leap that he was harmful.
Mm.
And maybe that bled into like what we now know is a massive red flag in interaction with a minor.
I did have one interaction with him, though, where I felt particularly frightened. It was about a week after he'd asked my friend out. He kept turning up at her house and pestering her to be his girlfriend. And she was, really pretty stressed and scared. So I was up in my cubby house. I can't remember if you were there at the time.
I don't think I was there for this. No.
Okay. So I was up in the cubby house, and he walked down the lane, and he stared up at me, and he said, why won't your friend go out with me? And he was, bordering on aggressive. And I said, well, being a little kid, I said, you're too old. You're too old for her.
Well said.
You know,
precisely the problem.
Yeah.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Straight to the point. So you're too old. She doesn't want to. She doesn't want a boyfriend. And, and he looked pissed off. He stared up at me in silence and stormed off. And I remember feeling absolutely terrified at the time. Like I'd really, really, really annoyed him.
Yeah.
And I remember running inside and telling mum and dad what had just happened. Yeah.
Wow.
Just concerned about the ramifications of that.
Like every now and again I have to remind myself that this is a 25-year-old man.
Yeah.
Like that is not 25-year-old man activities staring down a 13-year-old in a fucking treehouse.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well said. Well said. Mm. It's just not. It sounds like you got the flash of the rage, it sounds like you glimpsed that darkness.
I did.
The void inside. That's horrifying.
It was frightening.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm just so glad I was up in the treehouse and he was down in the laneway.
So even at this point, would you describe the family, the Bryants as a whole, as private? I mean, you've been living next door to each other for, I don't know, what, a decade at this point?
Yeah.
Very private.
I have no memory of interacting with any of them other than Martin. Because I think any interaction with Martin kind of sticks out because he's like, I don't think it's controversial to say he was a fucking weird dude, but... Mm. Yeah, I have none. I have no recollection, which you're right, is so strange because I can tell you who lived in every other house in the street, but I can't tell you a single thing about them.
They used to come around and pester mum for nectarines. Remember we had all those nectarine trees? And, the mum would come around and offer mum money for the nectarines and she'd get Martin to pick them. Yeah, it was.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you recall anything about what the mum was like, Lorraine?
Oh, not really, to be honest. Yeah. I thought it was a bit strange that she kept sort of nagging mum for the nectarines, but, you know, I was a kid. Yeah. I was more interested in climbing trees and
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Not picking nectarines. Yeah.
I mean, I know that after the massacre, she's spent her later years trying to basically claim it was all a conspiracy. And that they had it wrong. She read a book, you know, you might have heard about this, the autobiography, where she basically claims that her son was stitched up and they've got it all wrong and he's innocent.
So
she doesn't, I don't know.
Yeah. I guess she has to sort of cling to whatever reality is there. Keep it going, I guess.
On the one hand, it makes perfect sense. You know, on the one hand, you'd be like, oh my God, I just can't sleep at night thinking that this is true, this is real. But on the other hand, maybe it's indicative.
That she raised.
Yeah. Maybe on the other hand, it's indicative of a woman who was, I don't know, not quite, a little unhinged the whole time, or I don't know. Mm. I'm sure that there was stuff going on in that house.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think, like, even as kids, we knew that Martin exhibited antisocial behavior, weird stuff, like, just as kids, using our own intuition. So, like, I think it's really incumbent on the parent to maybe intercept with some education or some therapy or something.
Yeah.
I hope she doesn't listen to this, but I don't think that's hard to say, because, like, for anyone that interacted with him, it stuck at like dog's balls. Mm. This guy needed help.
Yeah. He did. Mm.
Yeah. Do you have any other memories, Mick, of sort of interactions with Martin as you got older?
Well, the only one that really comes to mind is seeing him a couple of weeks before the massacre, because I think if I have it straight in my head, the timeline, like, not long after, you know, those interactions you were talking about where he was trying to be the boyfriend of a 13-year-old, he moved in to Clare Street, which is like not far from where we are now, into the lady that had the Tattersalls fortune.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so basically, we didn't see him around the neighbourhood anywhere near as much. He had all this money and he was travelling. And
we just knew that he'd moved out down to Clare Street. So we were down in the laneway sort of near his old house.
Yeah.
He turned up and he looked incredibly different to what he used to sort of look like.
In what way?
He looked wealthy. And he'd grown his hair. He looked more confident.
He looked kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah.
To like teenage me, I was like, well, that's Martin. Like, holy shit.
Yeah, he didn't look like the goofy sort of Martin that we remembered. So he'd grown his hair long. He looked like a sort of cool sort of surfy dude. And he turned up with like white linen, which was kind of unusual for back then.
Yeah.
And sort of like, you know, these cool loafers and,
That's fascinating. Was he buying those or did he have like a personal stylist? I mean, you know, you can have heaps of money and not be cool and not dress cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. From what I know, but like this is just like the Wikipedia version, is that, he became notorious for wearing gaudy
sort of clothing.
I think he had a fixation with attention, good or bad, and he loved it. And because like in the 90s, no one was getting around in like white linen pants.
No.
Unless you were Bon Jovi or something.
Wow.
Yeah, so he came up to us and in his white linen and, he was really keen on impressing us, which was, you know, something that he did quite a bit, but yeah, it was sort of a bit more believable, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And a real confidence. It wasn't as awkward as it usually was.
I think none of us could believe that, like, this total fucking spud that we knew as a kid had money and he had the things.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, it's hard to argue with evidence. Mm. Like, apparently Martin's cool now.
Yeah. So he said that he had this, you know, high-flying job. He didn't, you know, go into details, but we believed him. And he was talking about all this travel that he'd been doing. And, you know, back then, like, you know, it was pretty unusual to go overseas. So, you know, we were pretty impressed, really, weren't we? He was talking about Paris and London and all these places that he'd been to. And, we just thought, gee, he's doing well. Like, he's pretty good.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, reporting back to Mum and Dad saying, we just, you know, saw Martin. He's like, he's going somewhere with his life, you know.
Yeah.
He's good.
Again, bearing in mind that, like, I was like 12.
Yeah.
And you were 15.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was our impression. We believed it all.
30-something dude just really laying it on a couple of kids, like, yeah, man, I got it sorted now. Like, so weird.
It is weird looking back at it. But, yeah, at the time we noticed a real change.
Yeah, wow. What did your parents say to that? Were they were they a little bit more privy to what was going on? Were they like, actually, guys?
Yeah? Probably.
Do you remember them pushing back?
I remember them sort of listening and
they probably thought we were full of shit.
Yeah, not really believing what we were saying was true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit skeptical, definitely. Yeah.
The person you're describing, he doesn't sound changed at all. It's not like international travel has given him this new sort of internal life.
No.
He was still desperate for attention, hungry for friends.
But there was more of a confidence about him, though. He was more sort of at ease.
Yeah. It's almost like at all times, even when he was trying to crack on to your friend, he's trying to project 10-year-old's version of a grown-up. Because a lot of what he's saying just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Like, he's got this high-flying job, but he spends, like, more than half the year traveling. And he's just got all these crazy clothes all of a sudden. Like, yeah, it's just it's a juvenile version of a successful adult. Because all of this money, he just, by an unfortunate fluke of the universe, he got his hands on. Not through anything other than just dumb luck, I think.
And, of course, the story is that he caused the car accident. You know, you guys might have seen Nitram. Yeah. There's that scene where he grabs the wheel and the car crashes. To you guys, does that seem entirely plausible?
Yeah.
Yeah, that impulsive behavior of
I was just about to say that the word impulsive just springs to mind.
Yeah.
Because I don't think he had the capacity to think through the next hour, 24 hours, a week or month.
Right.
He was just living in the moment.
I mean, this is a lot about the woman that he befriended as well. You know, this old heiress. She must have been equally lonely to put up with him for all those years.
Yeah, certainly.
That is a really bizarre piece to the puzzle, I think.
Seriously.
Because she was notorious for being really aloof and a loner and having heaps of pets or something like that, like to a ridiculous degree.
And neglecting her mum's, like, medical needs.
Yeah. So really two extraordinarily odd people just with ridiculous means found each other. And it didn't end well.
Did you guys know her? Was she a bit of a public figure walking around the streets?
No,
you wouldn't know. She was one of those reclusive millionaires that, like, just sounds like a total cliche. But
everyone knew the house, though.
Yeah.
The house is pretty well known in Newtown.
Is the house still there?
Yeah, it is.
Imagine it's heritage listed or something. It's an old, like, bluestone place or something, isn't
probably.
It? Like an old sort of castle-looking place.
Yeah, it really stands out. I don't know who's living in it now.
Okay, so Martin disappeared. He comes back wearing all these fancy clothes. And then, Mick, you were saying that you witnessed something of a goodbye. Do you want to tell me about that?
Well, yeah, that's – so the reason that Martin was there was to talk to one of our other neighbours. And, like, this neighbour's a lovely person and, you know, not involved in any wrongdoing at all, I should say. Yeah, the impression, like, in hindsight, what I think was happening was Martin was perhaps going to say goodbye or – I don't even know if he had the forethought to think that what he was doing would actually lead to consequences, but it was, again, I think that he wanted to show them, like, check out all this sweet stuff I've got here. You know, I don't know how the conversation went, but I imagine it was something like similar to what we heard, but, you know, like, I'm going to be famous soon or something. Like, Yeah, that's not a quote, but that's how I imagine the conversation going.
Okay, okay. As in you overheard some conversation to this effect and you're sort of filling in the gaps.
Well, I didn't really hear anything to that effect. But when we saw Martin, he was leaving our neighbour's house and sort of saying goodbye. And that's when we had our interaction there. And I guess, like, we hadn't seen him for years at that point. And then he appears 2 weeks before the massacre. So I'm assuming it was kind of like, yeah, either a goodbye or a check out what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
It was all quite odd.
Hey, we're going to stop here for a quick ad break, but we'll be right back with more What It Was Like.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Okay, let's move to the shooting. Mick, what do you remember about that day?
I remember Dad and I went fishing in Dunelly. When we were coming home, we had to use the same highway that you would use if you were coming from Port Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
So we were coming back and we had such a clear run. Dad and I were both looking at each other like, what's going on? Why is there no traffic?
Mm.
And then as we got closer to the city, we could see that basically everything was cordoned off all the way to the hospital, and we had to take a big detour around the city.
That's right.
And that's when we thought,
it took ages to get home. Yeah.
This just doesn't really happen in Hobart. What's going on? And then, yeah, that was the first inkling that we had that something was going wrong.
Mm.
And then by the time we made it home, I think, yeah, the news started to come out.
Yeah,
and then
we heard it wasn't long after
that. Yeah.
But the name hadn't been released.
Yeah, that night we heard the knock at the door and Mum and Dad both said, you know, go to your room.
Mm.
And we went into one of the rooms and we were like, being kids, we'd like, who's at the door? And we saw that it was our other neighbour.
That neighbour that he had like said goodbye to turned up at the front door crying and said, it's Martin. Martin did it, you know, uneasy that he missed something and you know, that he should have reported it. So I'm not quite sure, what he said to that neighbour. But, yeah, he was feeling pretty uneasy about it.
Mm.
But it's interesting that we both picked that it was Martin before the name was released. And we were saying to Mum and Dad, we think it's Martin.
Yeah.
Because we thought, That sounds like Martin.
Mm.
But we were quite definite about it. We thought, oh, that's...
Yeah. And Mum and Dad were like, you know, no, can't be. Because it's just so absurd for that to occur in our lives.
Yeah. But we were both confident, weren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, it also just sounds to me like you'd been living around this guy for years and years. You knew that he was dangerous. Or certainly he had a bad vibe.
Yeah.
So something goes down like this in Hobart, it makes sense that you guys are like, Martin.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. We somehow knew that this guy, if it was going to be anybody in our circle, it was definitely going to be this guy.
Mm.
Mm.
Mick, would you say that you were surprised?
Yes and no. I think like by virtue of the situation, you are surprised. Because it's just the most absurd thing that you can imagine. But also, I think we knew without knowing. Like we knew before we had confirmation on the news of his identity. So I think we all knew that this dude was weird. Mm. Your mind goes back to him shooting birds, the most bizarre interactions.
Mm.
And this constant sort of like want for attention that it feels like he always had. He wanted validation from like me, a six-year-old, as a teenager. So
yeah,
like this just feels like the ultimate scream for attention. Mm. So it's like
it was the right fit.
Yeah, it kind of did. Weirdly enough, it did make sense and it wasn't that surprising in the end.
Mm.
Mm. Tell me about the next couple of days and the next couple of weeks. What are your memories of this period? And Lorraine, let's start with you.
All very surreal, really. And it really terrifying because the level of communication back then was nowhere near what it's like these days. No internet. We're all terrified that someone that we knew was down at Port Arthur when it all happened. And I remember people making, so many phone calls to try and work out where everybody was and who was safe and, so it was a really frightening time.
And then I think there was like a lot of anger because famously a guy on Newtown Road is the one that sold him the weapons.
Mm.
So he sold him the automatic weapons and like 1,000 rounds of ammunition or something absurd like that. Yeah. And like I said, like he was a known entity in the community. Mm. Martin was known to be weird.
He would have entered that gun shop several times.
Yeah, he would have gone in there and the gun shop owner would have just known that he was rich.
Mm.
And it was like, hell yeah, buy as much ammo as you want without thinking what this guy's capable of. And yeah, the shop wasn't open for long after April 1996.
Right.
The community was not having it.
And did that shop owner, do you know what happened? Were they sort of forced out of town?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. If you're going to sell someone 1,000 rounds of ammo, you got some basic duty of care.
Yeah,
especially like because there was Newtown Road. He lived in, like Martin lived in Newtown for a great many years. People knew who he was and what he was like, and he was not a good candidate to sell automatic weapons to.
No. I mean, it feels important to mention that, well, certainly Tasmania, I think, had a much stronger gun culture at that point. This was the case that famously motivated the John Howard gun control laws.
Mm.
So at that time, my understanding was that guns were a much more socially accepted part of the Tasmanian fabric.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, at the time, it was pretty unregulated. Like the idea that you could walk in off the street. So Newtown is a pretty built-up area. It's pretty central. It's not far from the city.
Mm.
The idea that there's a gun shop that stocks high-powered weapons and automatic weapons.
Yeah, that's bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, evidently it must have been okay at the time. But, like, I guess selling ammunition at that quantity is still a bit dubious, I think.
And also likely, that the gun owner had interactions with Martin in the past.
Yeah.
Like as you said, like not a great candidate for
but I guess the Port Julian, like the laws at the time clearly were inadequate.
Very loose.
Yeah, it was pretty loose. I, for one, prefer this version of Australia that we currently live in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I want to talk about kind of the fallout. I mean, did Hobart change after this?
Well, I'd have to think yes. Like we went to Port Arthur
not that long
a couple of weeks ago, and it's hard. Like your mind goes there every time. No matter, like I was running a thought experiment in my head, like is it possible to experience Port Arthur without thinking about that day?
And without thinking, like, what would I do right now if gunshots started ringing out?
Yeah. Just imagining the scenario.
Especially having your kids
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Like watching, your kids and my daughter, like, experience the place, without having to think about that. And that brought me some solace. But, yeah, it's left a scar. Like, you know, we still think about it. And I know that there's like, there's a few people propagating, you know, conspiracy theories and those kinds of things. But when you're there, when you see the aftermath and you know the person that did it, it just sort of, I can't truck with the conspiracy theories because I was driving down the road and, you know, saw the ambulances go past. I mean, this, I just don't know of any way to manufacture that. So because we are such a small community here, that so many people are affected by it. It's just every time it's brought up, with, you know, and Peter Dutton bringing it up again, not to sort of politicize things, but you know, he brought it up again. It just doesn't serve any purpose. Not that we, you know, we choose to forget it. We'll commemorate it annually as we should and remember the people that lost their lives, but to bring it up outside of that context just feels appalling to me.
Yeah. Is it spoken about? You know, I'm curious, in the days leading up to this interview on this show, were any friends or family saying, hey, you sure you want to go and talk about this? Like, is this a good idea? Is there any of that?
I had my reservations, but when you first contact me, because I didn't want to sort of talk about it in any way that would, you know, misshape it or I think people have a morbid fascination with Martin Bryant, and you brought up the film Nitram. So I have no desire to see it because it's sort of like it just feels very icky, but I just can't imagine a film about Martin Bryant being interesting in any regard.
No,
he's just such a zero sum human. Like, he just offers absolutely zero.
Incredibly disrespectful to the family.
I think so.
That lost people in that massacre.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't have some sort of manifesto or some sort of like overarching political belief. This was just an abomination. So, yeah, to answer your question, I sort of spoke to you about that. I thought this was going to be like a tasteful sort of reflection on a pretty historic time for our community and for us. So, we did think about it pretty deeply. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad. I think that's important. I guess I'm just trying to get a gauge of, you know, I live in Melbourne. You guys are in Hobart to this day. I'm really curious about what the scars look like, the social scars. You know, is it considered in poor taste to go to a dinner party these days and bring it up or to mention it?
I don't think
it depends how it's discussed, really.
Yeah. I think like the shame of it being dragged into sort of, you know, conspiracy theory and I've had people from the mainland sort of ask questions that it's sort of like alluding to, like, you know, I've got my own theories. How real was it? That kind of thing. I find that pretty gross. Basically, I think, I don't know, I can't speak for everyone, but collectively I think we've done a pretty good job in moving on and commemorating it tastefully. And I think even, like I mentioned before, that Peter Dutton invoked the massacre for whatever reason. I'm not even sure what the reason is, but Jeremy Rockliffe is the current Premier and leader of the Liberal Party down here. The state Liberal Party, he shut it down, and rightly so. So, like, you know, I'm sure he has his political affiliations, but that's not going to win you any votes down here.
Yeah. Although it brings me great pleasure watching Peter Dutton do things to dissuade people to vote for him. So,
yeah, true.
It's almost worth it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, something I really want to finish with is just this idea of, you know, where did this guy come from? Like, when I'm examining my own reasons for wanting to do this, it really comes from a place of, I think that talking about atrocities is only really useful in the sense that maybe education or reflection allows us to have the best chance that we possibly can of avoiding it in the future. We got to learn.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested to hear what you guys learned about the psychological profile that you were seeing as kids that led to this atrocity. You know, what do you think you learned? Lorraine, let's go with you.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, there's far more education around, you know, the red flags, like these days, and I really feel that if there was someone like him in the community again, I feel that he would get picked up. You know, whereas back then, pre-internet, I think everyone just sort of dealt with it in their own way without reporting. So, yeah, therefore, you know, enabling him to become the person, you know, that he was and commit that terrible massacre.
Yeah. And Mick, what do you think you've learned?
I think that something you touched on before is we all collectively had an instinct about him, and we didn't turn that into bullying or anything. We didn't say, like, you know, this is the weirdo of the village, let's kick him out. We, you know, additionally, we didn't try and bring him into the fold because we were honestly terrified of him. But the thing that sticks out for me about him and all of my interactions were he was just so juvenile. He was just so intellectually and emotionally stilted. He really did feel like he was stuck in some sort of 12-year-old mindset. And everything, he was always seeking some sort of validation. Like, come play with me, trade this game.
Yeah.
I want to be your girlfriend. So I think his pattern of behavior was, an external validation that he was seeking. And somehow along the way, I think he was very much an ignored person in society as well. As in, I don't think he's, like I was saying before, his parents never, well, just by virtue of them being so invisible to everybody around, I don't imagine that they interacted meaningfully with him.
And would have sought him the treatment that he required.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, again, with the sort of grandiosity that he was always on about. And I think, well, he wasn't getting the recognition from just having money alone and traveling and talking to people. So I think there was just like this escalation that was occurring. And he thought of the most horrific thing that he could do to get attention. I don't know if he was cognizant enough to understand the repercussions of what he was going to do, but he knew that he would be famous for it, or infamous at least.
Totally, yeah. And, yeah. He understood on some real basic primal level that murder was the top of the sort of attention-seeking pyramid, that this is a button. Yep. This is the big red button if you really want some attention. And he was happy to push it. It's bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. In a child's mind, I'm sure that makes some sort of sense.
I mean, you know, he doesn't deserve empathy, I don't think. But I can't help but, as you've been telling this story, I'm realizing inside myself that I'm sort of feeling sorry for him sometimes. You know, to be this lonely, to be trying to befriend little kids, like to be in your 20s and trying to date like 14-year-olds, 13-year-olds. Like, this sounds like the world's most lonely person to me.
So lonely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling sorry for him as a child. But the fear, prevented us from interacting with him much more than what we did.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got one last question. Mick, as someone who grew up, you know, you guys grew up in this world. This is part of your personal history. What do you want listeners to know about this story?
I think getting back to what we were talking about before, that I think societally we have some sort of morbid fascination with people that do these types of things. But Mun is just a black hole. I think what we really need to do is commemorate the people that were lost and the community damage that has occurred, and just let him rot. If that's not too hard.
No, let him rot. And what about you, Lorraine? What would you like to get across to anyone listening?
I just feel for those families so much. And, you know, Tasmania is a really tight community. When it's spoken about in Tasmania, so many people have a connection. So it needs to be, spoken about with care.
Yeah.
to avoid, you know, re-traumatizing people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's wise words.
Yeah.
I don't think we should forget this. And you know, you guys have...
No, definitely have not.
...made it real. I can hear my daughter coming up the stairs. She's about to... you can possibly hear her too. But yeah. I'll let you go. And thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Julian.
Today's episode was produced by Rachel Tuffery. It was mixed by Jimmy Saunders, who also did our theme music. Evie Atkins is our intern. Our cover art is by Naomi Lee Beveridge. And this whole thing has been a Super Real production.